Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Dow slips below 12,000. China says U.S. is in default already. Saudi Arabia counters OPEC and actually lowers the price of oil by saying that they're going to increase production. We have some listener questions today and lots more on episode number 216 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, it's Andrew Horowitz. How are you? It is the middle of June. June 12th, 13th of 2011. Almost half the year is gone. The days are brighter and brighter, and the markets are dimmer and dimmer. We're seeing a lot of distribution in the markets right now. We're going to get to that, talk about some strategies on how you can actually, well, battle that or come away from this less scarred than you would under normal circumstances. We're going to go through some of that. I want to mention that coming up next week is Harry Dent. He's written a few different books, and he's been right on the overall process and the overall outlook of what's going to happen. Some of his earlier books on the S-curve and technology have been really interesting. And I think that, you know, we've had him on before, and I think that this is one of those guests that you really have enjoyed because I get a lot of email from you on that. We're going to get through that. We're going to talk about that. But I have lots of little things that I want to go through today with you and spend some time talking about, because it is one of those questionable times where we're starting to see the economics in the United States start to slow up, roll over, as we say. We're seeing that in the areas like Asia, they're continuing to increase interest rates and try to hold back inflation. We saw that in Korea last week. We saw another 25 basis point move. In Brazil, clearly there is some slowdown in the retail sales and a variety of the sectors, and that's really on the heels of all that they've done to not only stop foreign investment into the country, but also to do their best to put the brakes on. So this is kind of the old don't fight the Fed thing that's going on right now around the world. And when you mix that in with higher costs for fuel and concern about additional political unrest like we're seeing again in Yemen and in Syria, it's really horrible what's going on in Syria. Horrible. I mean, in all these places, but really the latest information that we're seeing out of Syria is just brutal. I feel really sad for everybody over there, and they're actually doing things like running through fire-raged fields to get out of the area and try to get into other countries that will accept them. In Yemen, they keep on protesting, even though the leader was recently hit by, I guess, a rocket or some type of a explosive device, and they're still doing their best to fight. Now, what's interesting, though, about the region, when there was a recent poll done about one of the greatest reasons for their the revolution and the rebellion and the revolting against the current leadership was not about democracy. You know, there's a lot of talk about they really want democracy, they want freedom. But the poll came up, and however this poll was actually created, where the number one reason was all about financial issues. They wanted greater financial opportunity. They wanted to have greater financial freedom to do and to work and to actually, you know, have a life that isn't so ridden with these high food costs, et cetera. Now, what's interesting about that is that at the same time, almost as a congratulation in some regard, and we talked about that, my thought was it's almost like a bribe or a bounty. You know, $40 billion was handed over to Egypt and a couple of other countries that went through this process. So if the end result is to have greater financial freedom, we hope that the money that's being given to them actually flows into their hands, because once it gets into the cycle of government and bureaucracy and a questionable, if not a unsettled leadership at this point, who knows where that money's going to go? We know we've seen waste here in our own country. Remember what happened back in the days of the Katrina and a few of the other hurricanes and disasters, how much money was wasted and never got to the people that actually needed it. So why do we think that the money that we give to these countries is actually going to get there? I think it's kind of, I guess it's stupid of us to actually even think that. But hopefully there will be some financial freedom and as well democracy in those countries. And if nothing else, less bloodshed and better times for them coming up. But this is a big issue right now that we're seeing the area, and we call it the MENA, M-E-N-A, Middle East, North Africa area, just continuing to have unrest. Right now we're thinking that, I don't know, about a $5 premium is added to oil right now due to the fact that the Libyan conflict keeps on going on and on and on. This is supposed to be, if you remember, a very swift, very painless entry and exit by the United States first, and then NATO and the allies, and all the people that were working on that in this particular incident. And we don't want to call it a war. Can't call anything a war. No, not a war. Nope. Can't say those scary words. It's a, you know, it's a political incident. It's a police action. It's a whatever else the politically correct word is. We're involved in there, and there just doesn't seem to be any progress being made. It's very sad. Here's the point, that we are suffering substantial increase in our prices of the commodity that we use the most around the world, aside from food, in the area of our cost for fuel. The longer this goes on, the greater effect it's going to have on consumers, which will then have a greater effect on confidence and the markets. And of course, the economy, all wrapped into one nice little neat package. So when we look at what's happening there and we see it as something happening in a faraway land, let's come to grips with the fact that this is going to affect us. Now, here's a couple of interesting points. Over the last few months, we have heard that Japan and the tsunami and all the things that went on in Japan is not going to slow down the global economy. Okay, hold on to that thought. The second thing we heard was that oil prices over 100 was not going to slow down the global economy. Or it wasn't going to interrupt the global growth thesis, whatever you want to call it, whatever word you want to use to describe what's going on. I find it incredibly hard to believe that anybody said that with a straight face. It's kind of like Jean-Claude Trichet saying how the European region is going to have growth, but it's going to see some slowing, and how the Greek situation is resolved, but yet behind the scenes it's not. And all the time saying it like he's serious. I mean, he stepped on himself in the last week's speeches probably 4 or 5 different times, contradicting his own words. And we're supposed to believe this? So when we look at what's happening with economists, when they're saying that, hey, we're not going to see any kind of reaction on a global basis due to Japan. Hey, guys, quick side note. Did you not notice the supply chain disruptions? Did you not notice that Toyota is going to have a 45% decline in revenue? Did you not notice that the overall supply chain where people have to order and what's happening not only for cars but also for technology has seen a very significant disruption, and that is causing a lot of problems for inventory? And by the way, raising oil by, let's call it 20% from where it was, is going to directly hit consumers, not only here in America, in the United States, but around the world. So if you're telling me that oil prices that are 20% higher are not going to affect the global growth model, does that mean you're telling me that you already had that price baked into your model? Or are you telling me that no matter what happens, all you're going to do is tell me that nothing is going to disrupt the global growth model, because you want to keep confidence up? And that's what this is all about. It's back to the old confidence game. It's back to when a stock drops, the company comes in and does a stock buyback, increases their dividend, restates their financial estimates in terms of, says that, hey, we are on track, nothing's changed. Caterpillar did that last week. They did it 2 weeks before that. So that's good, because we want to know what's happening with the company. We want transparency. We want communication. Important. But then we have the other side of it, where the markets are dropping off and banks are getting slammed. this concern about how much exposure there is to Greece with Bank of America, JP Morgan, et cetera, with the municipal bonds, JP Morgan, the biggest holder of munis in terms of the banks. Meredith Whitney coming out and saying how there's going to be some significant defaults over the next year or so. And at the same time, we have this unbelievable miracle on Friday. Some people call it a stick save. Then on Friday, exactly at 2 o'clock, on the button, two things happen. Markets are coming down. They see, like, you know, they continue to come down. Volume is building up in the United States equity markets. And then all of a sudden they turn around. Hold on, I'll give you the whole point. Of course it was temporarily, but here's what happened. An announcement came out on Friday at 2 p.m. Number one, that the permanent open market operations by the Fed, and they provided the insight into how much they're going to buy back through the QE2 through the end of June, which we know there was going to be a chunk done, and so they put that out. So that was, okay, one piece of information. The second piece that was market moving was that according to the Basel rules, which has been an active process being worked on through the global banks, they were looking at a 3% capital increase, a requirement to increase the capital base of banks to make sure they can withstand global financial shocks. And at 2 p.m. Friday, they come out with that somehow, of course, with an unnamed source, comes out on CNBC, I believe, that the new requirements may only be 2 to 2.5%, thereby allowing banks to have a much lower amount that has to be set aside and freedom to utilize that capital and not a hit on, you know, their balance sheets and possibly even earnings. Banks turn around. I mean, they do a U-turn from being dropping, and they just shoot directly up. We saw about a 50 or 60 basis point move up for the general markets, the Russell 2000, the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, the Dow. Amazing. 2 p.m. on a Friday. Why? 2 p.m. is a clear time that after the break, if you will, that traders get back to their desks after lunch, and they're looking for the next trade to move into or move out of. They're looking to square up before the weekend on a Friday. And lo and behold, we get this news, which is news that if it is concrete, you do not want to go into the weekend short banks. So the short cover happens, pushes markets up entirely because a lot of the banks are sometimes the driver for markets. And if that's happening, indices move up, futures move up, et cetera, or they're being moved as well. Now, meanwhile, the punchline to the story is that give about an hour and roll back over and markets close to the low for the day. The Dow did finish up below 12,000, which was a key point because remember something. Whenever you hit those milestone numbers, 11,000, 12,000, 1,500 on gold, or 1,000 on gold, what happens is that those are captured as frontline newspaper items the next day. Top of the first page, Dow is under 12,000. You saw that, right? Dow's under 12,000. So one of the things that if you are an investor in a hedge fund, if you're a hedge fund advisor, excuse me, or maybe even a mutual fund manager, you want to do your best to try to keep that up if possible. If it's close, you know, you pounce on the S&P futures towards the end of the day. You know, you hit some of the important stocks like IBM or Caterpillar. You know, you kind of, those stocks that are market moving in that they hold a big percentage of the index. And what you do is you hit those and they move it up. Well, that wasn't accomplished on Friday, which is important. So when you get these kind of situations, when you have a market that breaks support and falls below it, or you have a market or a stock that maybe breaks under a key moving average, like a 50, 100, 150 day, very important to take notice of that, especially when it happens and why it happens. Now, why it happened was obviously there's been a lot of negative sentiment from all of the economic data that's been coming out between the employment numbers and the leading indicators, the durable goods numbers, and the manufacturing numbers. We are clearly seeing a rollover in the economic activity. Now, that doesn't have to be terminal, right? It can go down, it can go up. But we are seeing a slowdown, which is, interestingly, and maybe even coincidentally, at the same time that we're seeing that the Fed is going to pull out of their quantitative easing, thereby having less liquidity throughout the markets. whether it's the fixed income markets or the equity markets. So when you put that together with China coming out and saying that their exports slowed down considerably and their imports rose, it says to a investor, an analyst, hey, wait a minute. We're seeing not only the U.S. slow down, but we're seeing numbers in the U.K. slow down and Germany roll over and the continuation of Brazil starting to slow, et cetera. And India is really having a hard time raising interest rates to tamp down inflation. And wow, maybe there is something to be said for all this. And then we get into the situation where, of course, no one wants to have the weekend risk, right? Nobody wants to really have the opportunity to be sitting in the wrong position. If they're a short-term trader with a hold over the weekend, because what will happen is that they can get any kind of surprise coming out of whether it's Asia or Europe. And, you know, it's, I don't know, you can't tell me you haven't noticed this, right? There is an amazing amount of merger and activity action that happens over the weekend that is announced early Monday. There's an amazing amount of things like Osama bin Laden all of a sudden being, you know, taken out on a Sunday night, or a resignation, or, you know, just amazing amount of information that happens over the weekend. And that's done purposely, by the way. It's done because it's done outside of market hours so that it can sink in. Nobody wants to put a shock on the market, unless it's positive, by the way, during market activity. Or better said, they don't want to put a shock to the markets when other markets don't have the opportunity to react. So you want to do it if you're, you know, one of these Fed policy managers or a country or a market, a company. You want to do these things outside of market hours as best as possible, allow it all to sink in. So right now we are involved in this weekend risk thing, and I wouldn't be surprised, by the way, we have no economics really on Monday. I wouldn't be surprised if Monday, because of the velocity on the downside, unless something else really dramatic and beneficial happens, to see a little bit of a drop through the early part of Monday, and then, you know, possibly because we're seeing some extremely oversold conditions. I say that with a little asterisk up there, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. But we're seeing some very significantly oversold conditions when it comes to many of the overall markets. Now, that doesn't talk to any particular stock, and it doesn't talk to any particular country. I'm just talking about the U.S. right now, and a broad-based concept of investor sentiment, looking at the AAII bullish sentiment index, by the way, which is now at 24. Under 25 is considered very contrarian as far as an indicator or an indication. Why? Well, it appears, and let's just tell you what the real backdrop of this is. When retail investors are really bullish, they seem to get it wrong. When they're very bearish, they seem to get it wrong. That's at least from the theory that comes from this particular index. It's used as a contrarian index because when you see this overly bullish sentiment, things are getting overheated. Think of it like inflation and deflation a bit. They think that retail investors, or they call it the dumb money, is, you probably heard of the dumb money index. Well, this is kind of one of them. They think that the dumb money is very emotional and they'll move in and out as the tide ebbs and flows, which is true. We can't deny that. We've seen that 100 different times. Well, this index was incredibly bullish in the beginning of the year, right towards the beginning of the year when things started dropping off, if you remember, right in the beginning, and then got a little bit bearish into March when things turned around a bit. And now, then it went up a bit all the way through about April, and then it's been tracking down ever since. So if you think about that, we're at the low point from where it's been in a long time at 24. And again, if you look back in history, under a 25 is usually considered a pretty reasonable level to say that things are a little bit too bearish out there and that there's too much worry and that they can turn around. Okay, put that on the side for a minute. Let's look at the next one. The McClellan Oscillator. Tom McClellan's been on the show before, and we talk about the oscillator. And the oscillator has a couple of different features. One of them is that, as Tom would say, if the oscillator lives above the zero line or it lives below the zero line, it's an indication of who's in charge. Above the zero line, if it's kind of making a complex up and down above the zero line, the bulls are in charge. If it's making a complex move below, the bears are in charge. Okay. Now, there's also some oversold and overbought indicators, meaning that, well, I guess we could look at it as an exhaustion point. That's probably the best way to look at it. Buyers can get exhausted after a while, and sellers can get exhausted after a while. What that means is if you have a mark somewhere under the, 150 to 200 number on the oscillator or above, what that means is that it's a short-term, possible exhaustion point. Well, right now, it's the lowest it's been for since March, when it dropped down dramatically. It's back under it, close to, 215, I think it is right now. So clearly in that area of exhaustion. Then we have the put-to-call ratio. Now, the put-to-call ratio is very simple. It looks at the amount of puts that are being bought to calls. A little more complicated than that, but let's just leave it at that. The put-to-call ratio is also another contrary indicator. When people are really hedging and they're really looking for the market to decline, they really bang in the put, very similar to when you see a very high short interest ratio, they may be right. But again, when it gets over the top in a level that's very much extended or really low, when it's at the point of nobody's buying any puts, no protection, that's when you can have a turning point. And right now, it's at 102. By the way, meaning there's if you got a 100%, you almost have puts on margin at this point. I mean, really, really coming over the top on buying puts compared to calls. Almost no calls being put, being bought as opposed to calls. So that's another contrary indicator. When you line that up on a chart, you can see what I'm talking about. As a matter of fact, I'll put the put-to-call ratio on the show notes for this show over at the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And I'll show you what I mean. Again, that's just another particular indicator that you want to take a look at. The other one that I think is really interesting to look at right now is the VIX. It's a bit perplexing because with a 8% slide in major markets since their height back a month ago, right? Or 6 weeks ago. You're seeing a VIX only at 18 or so. 18 or so. That's like the historic averages, you know, give or take. It dropped down to 14, which was really low a few weeks ago. It came up as high as, I think it was 20 on Friday. And then it dropped back again. As a matter of fact, as the selling pressure mounted, the VIX got a little bit, less fearful. Now, how is that? Well, the only way I can explain it is one of two ways. Either there's a ridiculous amount of complacency and there is really no fear out there, which you can't imagine people are selling. That's really the case, right? Actually, I'll give you three different ways. Number two, the VIX doesn't matter. It's not giving an accurate level of reading on really what is that fear gauge or what's appropriate, which therefore makes it very difficult to use as a hedge right now in a portfolio. Oftentimes what you would do is if you have an allocated portfolio of equities, you may want to use a VIX option as a hedge. Therefore, as the selling happens, your VIX will move up sharply and the option will move up sharply, et cetera. Well, that's not the case right now. So anybody that's using the VIX or even the VIX ETF as a play for volatility, it's really not that great of an option right now. Or a position, or a hedge. The other thing is, the third point is that the VIX doesn't correlate well right now with the equity markets, but rather, it's correlating much better with the dollar. In fact, we did some studies recently, and it shows how the dollar index is the dominant driving force in the markets right now. And if you think about that just for a moment, that makes a lot of sense. We've talked about this several times here. And if you recall, we talked about how there's this gigantic trade on the long euro, short dollar, long commodities, short dollar, buy anything else, is really the way that the game is being played. Because the theory is that the Fed is continue on their merry way with stomping down the valuation of the dollar. Now, here's a side note. This is exactly why China is saying that the U.S. has already defaulted. They're saying that the use of the dollar in the way that we have by pushing it down and devaluing the holdings of the of what they own, $1.5 trillion worth of U.S. debt, is a technical default. That's interesting. Weren't we the ones that were branding them as currency manipulators, but we didn't? Remember that Geithner was carrying around that letter in his breast pocket of his suit? Kind of like, you know, walking into a store and having that fake gun in your pocket and saying this is a stick-up? Really not having it, but trying to use it as motivation and fear? Well, that's kind of what Geithner was doing all this time. he had that fake pistol utilizing his finger in his pocket, trying to convince China to allow their yuan to rise. And by the way, whether it worked or not, who knows? But they did. They allowed the exchange rate float to be removed, or the lock, I should say, and allowed it to actually start running. And the yuan has run. The reason we wanted that was that we wanted, of course, their currency to be valued more than ours so that they could buy our products at a cheaper rate. But, of course, we said that it's because their economy is overheating. This will be a good way to stop all the exports and to create domestic demand. Now, you have to think about what I just said. Slow down the exports and create domestic demand to make sure their economy is well-balanced and competitive and self-sustaining. Here's the punchline. This is the really funny part. So last week, we get the report on Thursday that China's exports have dropped, but their imports have increased. Now, that makes sense. If they have a rising value of their currency, less people will be buying their products from other countries, and yet imports will increase because their currency is worth more. Exactly what Geithner had wanted, which, by the way, I never understood. I thought about it and thought about it. I tried to think about, okay, what is the benefit here? The only benefit would be if China would buy our products. They don't want our products. They have plenty of their own products. And why in the world would we want their currency to rise if, in fact, it would create a much higher cost to buy their products, which we use, I mean, I don't want to say exclusively, but we use a lot of their products. I think it's something like $390 or $400 billion a year of their product. They have the cheap manufacturing, which now is more expensive because the price of the dollar went down and the yuan went up. So that doesn't work. We also don't want to see their economy slowing from an export standpoint, but it did, and that's because the yuan probably went up, also mixed into the global economy. And now everybody freaks out and says, oh my God, the driver of the economic demand and the global recovery, China, is slowing. Oh my God. Now I need to know, what in the world did Geithner think was going to happen when he and the Congress proposed that they should really normalize their currency? If we're still in an environment of a global recovery, particularly here in the United States, why would we want this to happen? It makes absolutely no sense. But the brilliance, once again, of Geithner shows through. By the way, I'm not a really big fan of his. I'm really not. I think that his job is to do whatever he can to... He's kind of like the kneecapper of the world. He's the guy that goes in, and when he goes in, you know, when he comes out, people are going to be, you know, a whole different position. They're going to be talking a different story. It's happened several times. And I just don't get how we allow for his blathering of, honestly, just pointless information that comes out of him on a regular basis to be, you know, even thought of as something that's even remotely believable. And you notice probably that he hasn't come out that often lately. I think the reality is that many have already discounted his overall sincerity and forthrightness, we'll say, I guess is the right way to say it. And I think China knows this already as well. That's why they punch back. And they're talking about us being in default because they want us to fix our financial situation with owning all those bonds. They want us to do something about the debt ceiling. They want us to stop dilly-dallying around with all this, and they don't want to see a rating adjustment because that will devalue the value even more of their U.S. holdings. So back to the whole idea that we see, this currency situation and the area of our currency being the driving force in the markets is because the lower the value of the dollar, the better it is for our companies in terms of export, foreign exchange rates. We've heard this time and time again on their conference calls. As the dollar rises, also, it has an adjustment on the price of oil. That's good, but yet bad for commodities. Because there's so much of the trading environment being short dollar, long euro, or anything else, or utilizing leverage to buy equities through borrowing the dollar and doing some other kind of carry trade, the fact of the matter is that the rise in the dollar past a certain point becomes very problematic to the U.S. markets, thus transforms it into a highly correlated currency or highly correlated item with the VIX. So you see the VIX did tick up, but it really didn't go as high because I think there still is a belief that our government is going to do whatever it takes to keep that dollar depressed. QE3, maybe not. QE2.5, probably. And I think it's already been designed. By the use of rolling over existing treasuries into new treasuries, not pulling the money out of the markets, is a way of continuing the quantitative easing. In other words, not shrinking the Fed's balance sheets by actually getting rid of any of the debt they've accumulated. So the pressure on the dollar will probably still be there, depending on how great the global risk actually gets. In the end, everybody comes home to Papa. Papa and Mama. Papa being the U.S. and Mama being Japan, the Japanese yen. You've seen the Japanese yen actually moving up recently because there is a concern about the global economy. It is not fundamentally, it's not at all fundamentally real because we know that Japan's finances are an absolute mess. We know that their bonds are probably going to be further downgraded. We know they have extraordinary amounts of debt and probably have to do some quantitative easing on their own, but nobody has any respect for that. They keep on buying it and buying it because it's a safety haven, just what it is. U.S. and Japan. So the idea that the U.S. dollar may move up is really creating a lot of the uncertainty and a lot of the fluctuations in the markets. If you watch the euro only, put it on a 10-minute chart, and you put the S&P 500 or the Dow, whatever you want, next to it, you'll see almost the exact same charting tick by tick or minute by minute or 10 minute by 10 minute. And the reason is the correlation is so high right now that traders know that if we breach certain levels over the top of the dollar spot, that we can have a real problem. We saw gold sell off. We saw oil sell off at the end of last week. We saw it for two reasons. Number one, the dollar started moving, and Saudi Arabia, in direct opposition to OPEC, said, you know what, we're gonna release some more oil. Now, this is a great topic because I think it sets the stage for really the inside track of what's happening and why there's so much confusion when it comes to the markets and finances, the economy, government. Because here you have Saudi Arabia. They're saying, you know what, we need to do something about oil. That oil should be in the range of about $70 to $80. Meanwhile, the rest of OPEC says, hey, you know what, there's plenty of inventory out there. We don't need to increase inventory. We don't need to increase the production. Well, yeah, I get that. In fact, if you look at the inventory numbers on oil, they're close to record highs. On a week-to-week basis, they move around, but the trend has been that they've been growing dramatically. Now, gasoline inventories, on the other hand, they've been kind of getting a little bit less and less. But at the same time, there's two reasons for that. Number one, you have the seasonality. Clearly, the summer months are the season when you have more activity, whether it's boating or traveling or whatever it may be. The second thing that you have is that you see that there is a dramatic increase in pricing going on. So why not refine as much oil as you can, put it into gasoline, and do your best to store it? On the other hand, if you think that they'll be coming down in the future, don't build up so much inventory. When we see these highs happening, you know what? You may want to back off a little bit from refining it. Why would anybody want to hold excess inventories? So there's this kind of push and pull when it comes to the inventories between oil, distillates, and gas, and they're still in really good balance. So I don't think it's really the inventory situation that is driving up prices. It's speculation about what the future is going to bring. It's the Libyan conflict. But yet OPEC, without realization, or maybe with realization, that $100 plus oil is going to have a dramatic impact on not only demand for oil, but also on the global recovery, maybe they don't care about what that means for everybody else. They're oil rich, for goodness sakes. They don't care. If there's an uprising in Saudi Arabia, shell out $40, $50 billion to the people. Let them eat cake. Right? That's what they did. So I think that this whole idea of oil inventory shortage and the speculation is the issue. Then we have, again, the final leg in all this. Oil prices are going up. People complaining. Not good in a time period where we have elections in a couple of years, right? So what does President Obama do for the second time? Comes out with a statement that if oil prices stay high, we're going to open up or consider, because then it gives you an out, consider the strategic oil reserves. Well, unfortunately, sir, it is my understanding that the strategic oil reserves are only for problems arising from inventory shortages. I just told you, if you want to go look, I'll send you the data. I just told you that there is no problem with inventories. We have no problem at all with inventories. It's pricing. Therefore, sir, may I say, why don't you go give a little bit of a nudge over to the CME again, ICE, etc., and tell them to do the same thing they did with silver. Tell them the same thing they did recently with oil before. Raise the margin requirement. Raise the initial deposit requirements. It makes a lot more sense than lip service about the strategic oil reserves, I got to tell you, because it's almost insulting. It's almost like, well, we know you're not going to do that. Why are you telling us that? Is it somehow we're supposed to just buy into everything that's being said right now? Like, for example, that the stimulus package is going to be shovel ready? We know what that was. It wasn't shovel ready. Like, the quantitative easing is going to create jobs? Save or create. I don't think it was really that, but okay. I think it was really the global demand, and I think that it was a much greater level of confidence that was brought after the significant downturn. We had fear of calamity, catastrophe. So if you want to say that the use of the funds, whether it was TARP or the stimulus or the QE1 or the QE2, was used in a way that was able to calm the fears and bring back confidence, all right, I'll go there. But to say that it did anything more than that is, I don't know. Recent reports showed that about $950 or $80 billion of household equity has been returned or so in the last year. Well, that's great. Unfortunately, we spent like $1 trillion getting there. So you know what? Next time, do me a favor. Send me a check for $50,000, okay? And everybody else in the country the same. And let's just call it even. Why bother with the charade? Because if you send me money, you don't have to pay interest on it. If you send me money, it will directly come into my pocket, and I guarantee you I'm just going to spend some of that. If you buy bonds through the Treasury and through the Fed, I'm not sure if I'm going to do anything with that. And if you do stimulus that doesn't go directly into the pocket of someone, in other words, it goes through the bureaucratic mechanism of getting the stimulus out, putting the stimulus maybe to a city or a municipality that maybe gets bids and it's overcharged and money falls to the wayside and it's not found and it drips out over time, I don't know how that's going to benefit me. Am I wrong? All right, let's move on to a couple of other things I want to go through here. The last week we had Terry Bedford on, and I mentioned a couple of stocks, and I want to share a couple of points with you. So I mentioned one particular stock, Mercado Libre, and I said, you know, Terry, did you look at the chart of this lately, even through a lot of this market downturn? It's been holding up. It's been holding on its 50 and 10 week. And he said, yeah, that looks really good. I said, yeah, we like that. We hold a little bit of it. Well, lo and behold, a couple of days later, stock just pukes, falls out of bed. Now, you go, what changed? What happened here? Well, aside from the fact that you're in an environment that is very tricky right now because we have corrective action and distribution going on in the markets, you have a little situation in Peru. So Peru has an election, and the gent that gets in is not liked by the markets at all. Matter of fact, the day that the election results come in, Peru's market drops 12% before it's being shut down for the day. 12% in one day. That's a big move. And the concern about the economic results that will occur after this gent is actually sworn in has been rippling through Latin America. So companies that do a lot of business in Latin America or in Peru, they're concerned. And investors are backing away. Now, we looked up, by the way, one caveat and one point. So when the stock did roll over and we saw it starting to take down, we moved out of the stock and moved to the sideline so we didn't get hit, you know. So you have to be aware that that is the game right now, right? You have to be aware that markets are volatile. If stocks do not go in the way that you want them to be, whether it's short or long, you have to move to the side till it becomes a better point to buy in. Nobody ever said that you have to hold on to a stock forever through any kind of market move. There's always another day. Now, not everybody can do that, I understand. But this is just a good example of what's going on right now and how to deal with it. So Meli drops, we're out of it. Meli drops, we're trying to look for information. Why is that? In other words, we're not going to sit on the side, just wait for this thing just to, you know, fall out on us before we can understand what happens. You know what? The price is the truth, right? Markets are always right. In other words, it can go down and the fundamentals can be great. In fact, we couldn't find any significant exposure to Peru from Meli at all. So we're sitting there scratching our head. Meanwhile, it keeps going down. So we're sitting there looking at it going, I don't know what's happening here, but you know what? Something's up. Meanwhile, we may get back into this stock. We may. Fundamentals are strong unless we see something else that, you know, doesn't make any sense. But right now, the fear of Meli, Mercado Libre, the eBay of Latin America, if you will, that does a lot of business in other countries other than Peru. They do, I mean, hardly any that we saw. You know, I have to realize that this kind of situation resonates. Now, look also at the Chinese stocks. Great story about Muddy Waters last week on Bloomberg, and it talked about how there was a report that came out on Sinoforest, which is a firm that does obviously forestry, et cetera. But there was a supposedly a material misstatement of how much land they owned. Now this is on the heels of other companies that supposedly have, well, no businesses, but they back-end into a U.S.-based company through a reverse merger. We used to call it blind pools, that kind of thing. And these companies are misstating, or I shouldn't even say misstating, they're lying. It's fraud that they're putting this information down on their various balance sheets and cash flow statements that are just materially incorrect. So, you know, as an investor, you're looking at this all this information, trying to find out what you can. And meanwhile, it's not right. Well, let's go one step further. So this particular company, they write up a whole piece. Now, supposedly, this was pre-marketed to hedge funds and investors 2 weeks before the report came out, which is interesting. So in other words, you get all your players lined up. You tell them the date that this report, that's going to be the scathing report about their finances, come out. And then they just whack the stock. When I say whack the stock, I'm talking about 75%. Okay, this stock went down 75%. Supposedly it cost Paulson, you know, that famous hedge fund fella, his fund somewhere about $325 million. A couple other guys get caught in this as well. Now you have to wonder, is there credence to the claim? Well, we'll see. But this now, on top of all the other issues and that the SEC is investigating many of the Chinese firms that have done these reverse mergers, and Interactive Brokers, for example, is not allowing leverage on about 160 different Chinese companies, is starting to spook the entire space. From Baidu to Sina, Sohu, NetEase. I mean, these companies have just fallen out. Sina was down about 20 points last week, or 20%. So there's a potential disaster looming on this Chinese stock issue. But then again, for those companies that we found to be solid, real companies, is going to be a great buying opportunity. We actually slipped in a little bit of Sina for a swing trade at the late part of Friday as it was kind of coming into the zone of about 90 bucks or so. It slipped from about 140 recently. Now, Sina could move down again. Yes, we will be out of it before there's any real downdraft here, especially because we're doing this on a swing trade basis. But we've owned Sina back and forth several times. And now there's a different story, of course, because now you have this overhang of this whole China issue. But Sina is not one of these little babies out there that is, I think as questionable. Is Baidu questionable? I don't know. I mean, maybe everything's questionable. I mean, clearly the banks were questionable. But are they doing such bad accounting right now? These are well-rounded, well-run companies that are well-known. These aren't the little rinky-dinks out there. But we'll see. Point, though, is that you have to be careful to watch the charts. And that brings us to the next point, that in this environment, you can't be afraid to either step in or step out of a position. If you are in an environment that is very uncomfortable, then there's going to be more volatility. Try not to. Let emotions take over. And the way you do that, the best way to do that is to have a plan. What you want to do is, before you do anything, before you react, know what your plan is. If you are willing to get into a market that's moving on a downtrend, which is not the best idea in the world, by the way, but not at all, you wait for at least a turn to do something to give you some signals. Hold on to the positions that are holding up well. The ones that break down, get out, but find a place that you want, if they're fundamentally sound, to get back in if markets turn. Very core and basic strategy. At the same time, you may want to look to hedging your portfolio. So we use ETFs, we use options to hedge the portfolio throughout over time. We'll be in a hedge up to a certain point. For example, we weren't going to, let me give you a good example. So you have a portfolio of stocks. We said, you know what? When you look at all the breakpoints of the markets, you have to break down below here before we get into a hedge. On the other hand, if you break up, you have to get out of the hedge. So this can happen. You want to wait to a reasonable level above or below. So for example, using 1300 on the S&P as an example, below 1300 and a clear break below 1300 leads you to the next point, which maybe is a 1275. Below 1275, you go to 1265, then down to 1250. 1250 is a very important support point. There's a lot of support down there. Now, that doesn't mean we can blow right past it and be down to 1225 very quickly, but there's a lot of support at 1250. You're going to see that institutions will pop in there at least for an attempt to hold the positions there. Because if not, they know you're going to see the next level, and so on and so on. The same thing happens on the other side. My friend Corey calls it pop stops. Corey Rosenblum. He says that, when you see the indices getting past very important resistance areas, all those shorts will cover. We know this. Key resistance areas cause shorts to cover, and key support areas that break through cause longs to sell and shorts to initiate, right? Vice versa. That's why at those levels you get the biggest fight. Now, right now we did break down on the, on almost all major averages we have broken down. We're actually negative on the year on the NASDAQ and on the Russell. Slightly, but negative. And right now what you want to do is look at utilizing hedges throughout the throughout your portfolio, maybe on a broad basis. Use something like SDS, the inverse of the 2x inverse of the S&P 500. but only up to a point. When you see that it can't get below a certain point, you have to pull your hedge. So if you have a portfolio of 50% stocks, maybe you want to have a 25 or 30% position in SDS that will give you approximately, depending on the risk level of the stocks in your portfolio, some level of risk mitigation. Not entirely, but some. Individual stocks will often break down much harder than an entire index will because it's more diversified. 500 stocks versus 20. I mean, you know, it's just more diversified. So when right now in this environment, that's what you want to do. I will tell you that you want to also look for key turning points because there is still liquidity in this market. There is still optimism by the corporate management. There's still optimism by the major hedge funds out there. So you want to look for those key turning points because what we could see and what we're projecting here is continual choppiness till about the end of June. And why the end of June? Unless something to the contrary, unless we see a major default of Greece, unless we see significantly worse economics, something really bad and that is going to be a shock situation. What we're going to find, I believe, is that the earnings are not as bad as they're being made to be. We did not see companies come out with any significant downside revisions. We did not see companies come out with any outlooks that were really negative that haven't been taken to the woodshed already. And on top of that, we're not seeing any murmurs of that because we think that they're still cutting expenses, and that's why we're seeing a higher level of unemployment. It's almost to a point that where unemployment starts getting better, in other words, we start putting on a lot of jobs, it concerns me. I know this is a little upside down because the expenses will go up, and we've seen this. But you have to realize something very important. That's why the reaction last week to the numbers on the global basis was much more important than what we may have seen in the U.S. alone. The U.S. is very reliant on the global economy. The unemployment here is only one part of the equation, so don't get hung up on it. It's important, but don't get hung up on it because you have to see, well, what's the unemployment rate over there? What's the unemployment rate over there? You know, how is their economy going? You know, and how does that react with our economy? So it's kind of like a big puzzle that you need to put together right now. Okay, so let me get to... I got to talk about this. I want to talk about the silver, an update on silver. So we've been in and out of silver. I think I've mentioned a few times that we have a negative opinion on silver. Actually, frustratingly, we moved out of the silver on Thursday, and then on Friday it dropped 3%. It kind of gapped down at the open there, and it actually finished up below a very important level, below the 100-day moving average for silver. That's a important support point, and we'll see if it can actually make it above. If not, by the way, folks, you have another entry point about to happen. If the dollar continues to move higher, you will see silver, in my opinion, get smacked. Underneath this level, you have another 10% downdraft that can happen very quickly. Now, if you haven't followed a lot of our conversation on silver, we have placed charts, tables, and a lot of indications of what could happen and what the setup is for silver on the website, on the Disciplined Investor. Matter of fact, Barron's picked us up on a piece that we wrote last week. And, you know, if you have, for example, you can follow us on Twitter. It's just go to... what's Twitter here? Andrew Horowitz at Twitter. Just if you want to get instant access to when a post goes up on something, just do that. Or just come back to the website whenever you feel like it, and then maybe you'll miss it, maybe you won't. You can also sign up for the daily culmination feed right at the top of the website. Just put your email in, and you'll get a daily recap of the things that we write. But silver is going to have a very big drop if it can't get above this 100-day moving average because there's a gap below there. The gap down is going to be down to about 10% down from here. So below that, you have another problem. If you get below about 32, oops, that's going to be a big and ugly. Some are predicting a 45% drop from this level. That will trace back almost identically the levels that we saw from the up to the down, the big whoosh up, and then the big smack down back in the 80s. We talked about that, about the whole Hunt brothers cornering the market. You've probably heard about this. So These are things that I think that are probably bound to happen. I think that what is happening right now is that the people who went into silver, were holding it forever, decided to get out when they increased the margin and maybe when they realized how much this can be volatile against them. And at the same time, you have the other people that got in and jumped back in when it started going back up recently, saying, hey, it was overdone. And then, oops, they got smacked again. And they're like, you know what, I'm out of this. And then you got the next round, which is going to be people didn't get out last time. And the people that were really newly in saying, I'm not putting up with this anymore. And if they all start running for the hills, it's going to get ugly. Now, you can invest in an option. You can go short SLV, or you can use ZSL, which is the inverse, two times inverse of the silver index. And we are in and out of that because some of the overnight hold is a little bit risky on silver. So we move in and out of it depending on the exact levels. We've done it several times over the last few weeks. We unfortunately missed that Friday move, and it was kind of it was very quick and very it was painful to watch not being in it. You know? So, all right, a couple of questions came in. Let me get the questions over here, and then we'll wrap it up. Again, Harry Dent next week on the show. All right, listen, we have, who's this? Liz from Chicago writes, and by the way, anybody that wants to write in, just send it off to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Let's see. Liz from Chicago writes, can you explain how I can find a good stock research tool? I'm using Yahoo Finance now. Thanks for your help and love the show. Okay, hey, Liz, listen. Here's one of the things that you can use, I think, is there's a few different places. Bloomberg just redesigned their site. I'm not really a big fan of the new redesign. There's some cool stuff on there for news. But from a research standpoint, you can go over to FinViz. I've talked about them before because they have these screeners and they have some reasonable pre-built charts. But the screener is really where you could start. You can find maybe stocks in a sector that meet a certain criteria for earnings and growth, a balance sheet, et cetera. And you can find a list there. Then you can use then, for example, stockcharts.com. They have a free version and a paid for version. And you really can get kind of everything you need right there. There's some more very sophisticated packages. You pay a lot more money, but I think that will get you by. There's some really good stuff in there. Troy from New Brunswick. Hey, Andrew, love this show. Great guests. Why are the government government employment numbers so varied, in particular the revisions? What gives? Yeah, good question. You know, one of the things about, I guess, about the government employment numbers are their estimates at first. They come back the next month and they give a revision. They have different pools of people that they will look at for, let's say, initial claims, obviously, is what comes in, and then they're going to revise it when they get the final numbers. The unemployment rate is one number. The NFP payrolls is kind of from a different grouping. So there's all these different things. Plus, they put on a couple of calculations on each to come up with, you know, their number. But the main thing is that they're volatile because, first of all, there is volatility. But second of all, because they don't have all the information. And a lot of times, they're going to use a best guess. But also, even more importantly, sometimes they use seasonality. So what they'll do is they have a birth-death model of new businesses and people that should be employed, that could be employed, and that goes into it, and that varies depending on the time period. So you get these really wacky numbers sometimes. You know, you go from, for example, a few months ago, right? Probably what you're considering is you had this unemployment rate just sneak down on us. It's like, wow, that's good. How's that possible? But it's good. And then all of a sudden, there it goes. The next month or so, it's back up to 9.1. So I hear your frustration. All right, we have Bert that wrote in. He says, I was wondering how to track economic data regularly. Now I'm watching what's available in the news, but where is additional information available? Yeah, that's a good question. So economics, there's a few different places you can go. One of the places that I don't think a lot of people know about is the St. Louis Fed. Now, what's neat about that is you can actually sign up for a weekly compendium of the information. They also have some great charts on just a whole host of series. So you can go to the St. Louis Fed, look them up. The second place would be dismal.com, economy.com. They have a free site and they have a pay site. You have briefing.com, which is good because they have great analysis. And then you also have a freebie called Econo Day. Econo Day. Econo Day. Let's look up Econo Day. That's put out by Bloomberg, but there's a kind of a separate site that has a calendar of what's happening, what to look for, the importance of it, past numbers, etc. So that's all there. So St. Louis for charting and for information. You got Dismal for some charting analysis and briefing for analysis. And then you have over at Econo Day, you have the mixture of analysis calendar and all that. I mean, all of these have some of that, but the freebies are Econo Day, and there's an app for it actually on various phones, etc. So I hope that helps. Any questions you have, just send them on over. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And also want to mention to you that if you want, I really encourage you actually to, the more I'm thinking about this, to sign up for the, or to get online with the Twitter over at Andrew Horowitz at Twitter, or however you put that in. And all of the posts that we do go right over there, and every once in a while we'll throw some extra things on there that you need to be looking at. So at least you get an alert, if you will, if you follow Twitter, of what's happening very, very quickly. Or go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check out what's there. I'll put that put-call ratio on the show notes from this show, plus some other information that you may want to check out, and make sure you head over there. Until next week when we have Harry Dent on, I want to thank you for joining me. And watch for that turnaround if it's going to happen early in the week, and then get ready for some additional volatility into the end of the week, because we do have options expiration where volume will kick up, and we're awfully close to a couple of key numbers that some of the players are going to want to keep their options away from so they won't have to pay. So watch that as well. I would venture to say that we may see an early week kick up and then some real ugliness kicking in if we see bad economic data and into the options expiration, particularly, you know, Thursday-ish. So just an idea. It may or may not pan out, but just an idea of what to look for and why we're looking for that from a kind of an overview top-down approach, or an eagle's eye approach of the market and sentiment. Thanks again for joining me. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.